Welcome to Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I'm delighted to be joined by Joseph Pierce, a writer in residence at Ave Maria University, Florida, who has written numerous literary biographies, including Literary Converts, Tolkien, Man and Myth, The Unmasking of Oscar Wilde, Wisdom and Innocence, A Life of G.K. Chesterton, and The Quest for Shakespeare. With Joseph Pierce, we go inside the pages of Solzhenitsyn, A Soul in Exile, the revised and updated edition published by Ignatius Press. Incredible about this book is that you had the opportunity to actually meet Alexander Solzhenitsyn.
I did. It was one of the great honors of my life and a very surprising one because at the time that I wrote to him, well, first of all, I can't now remember how I found his address, so that's a mystery to me, how I found his mailing address. Wow. Somehow I did, because he's a very secretive chap. And I wrote to him, and just saying that, I'm a young writer. I'd only published one book at the time. I told him I'd written a biography of G.K. Chesterton. That was the only thing published at the time. This was back in probably 1997. And saying that I didn't think any previous biographies of him had actually done justice to his Christian faith or to the centrality of that faith to his work and to his life and to his ideas. And I thought, my position was, that he probably won't reply, in which case you're nothing ventured, nothing gained. But the probably best I could hope for is that, he would reply saying, thanks, but no thanks, but at least as a fan, I'd have Alexander Solzhenitsyn's autograph, which would be worthwhile. But then when he actually replied saying, yes, please come and to Moscow to interview me and give me the address of two of his sons to act as intermediaries and translators, etc., I was astonished because, as I say, he hadn't spoken to any, he'd refused to be interviewed by any Western writers for about 10 years prior to this. And here am I, sort of a young writer with only one book published to my name, and for some reason he decides to grant an interview to me when he hadn't to all these other people. And of course, I can only presume it was because he agreed with me. In fact, I know that he agreed with me because he told me when I went to Moscow that he agreed that the previous biographers had not paid due respect and due deference to the importance of his Christianity, his orthodoxy to his life and his works.
Why do you suppose that was?
Well, we live in a secular age, as you know, and the official, so-called official biography of Solzhenitsyn was by Michael Scammell, and it was very good in many ways, but it did not pay due attention to the theology and the philosophy that underpins Solzhenitsyn's politics. I mean, for Solzhenitsyn, politics are merely a derivative of religious and philosophical assumptions. So you can't just talk about a person's politics, at least not a deep thinker like Solzhenitsyn, without paying due attention to his faith. So Scammell's biography and other biographies fail to address that issue. And of course, my hope was that my book would achieve that, and I think it has.
I love it. I have to say that every time you write a book, you write it in such a way, it's almost like a great romance. And what I mean by that, I mean it in the true sense of all the color, the breadth and the emotion of the person's life that you're presenting. And that's a rare thing to do. Maybe it because it does have that elements of that spirit of faith that permeates, that makes it so colorful.
Yeah, well, I think there's a few things here. Obviously, that the people I choose to write about are already colorful people and men of faith. And I am a great admirer of them and lovers of them. And their lives are great romances. And if you have to love people, of course, and that love has to come through in your work. And the people I write about, I don't just admire in some sort of a dispassionate way. I do actually feel as if in the course of the research, I get to know them. I sometimes sort of quip that some of my best friends are dead, in the sense that, that I really do feel as if I know Tolkien and Lewis and Chesterton and Roy Campbell and some of these people have written about, better than the many acquaintances I have that are alive. Because when you spend months researching someone, obviously you get to know them very well. And of course, Solzhenitsyn was, unlike the others, actually still alive when I wrote about him, first of all, and I had the great pleasure of going to interview him, which obviously wasn't a pleasure I had with the likes of Chesterton or Belloc, etc. But the other thing about that, it meant that the book was a work in progress, because Solzhenitsyn went to live went on to live for a further 10 years after I interviewed him in 1998. He died in 2008. So, of course, the book was literally unfinished. And so the new revised and expanded edition by Ignatius Press, you know, brings the story up to its conclusion with Solzhenitsyn's death and the aftermath to his death, the funeral and the tributes to him. And there's an extra sort of three or four new chapters and some additional material throughout the rest of the text as well.
I love it. For those who are not familiar with Alexander Solzhenitsyn and his legacy, tell us what you would want them to know about him.
Well, I suppose that the first thing they would need to know, which obviously is told in, you know, with much more detail in the book, are the bare bones of his life and the importance of that life. So he was born in 1918, a year after the Communist Revolution. So he was subjected to a secular fundamentalist state school education, you know, in a more sort of obvious way, but in many ways not that different from the public school education we get in the United States today. It was secularist, fundamentalist, relativist. So Solzhenitsyn, brainwashed by that public school education, became a Marxist and an atheist, anti-Christian, and a member of the Communist Party. He fought for the Soviet Union in the Second World War against the Germans on the Eastern Front and was an officer in the army and received medals for his bravery in battle. But he was arrested while serving in the army for writing a private letter to a friend in which, in the private letter, so not publicly, in the private letter, he criticized Joseph Stalin. And, of course, in a police state like Russia, his letter was opened by the secret police, read, and he was arrested, sentenced to 5 years hard labor in prison, and then internal exile afterwards. And basically, Solzhenitsyn's life after that is he made a resolution in prison to expose the communist system for the fullness of its evil and the way it treats its people and the way it treats Christians. And that's what he fulfilled that promise many times over with the works that he wrote after he got out of prison.
One of those works, One Day in the Life, is the real turning point for him and getting his message out into the world. That in itself, how that was able to make it through the Iron Curtain, is an extraordinary story.
Yeah, basically what happened, I mean, this is how providence works, really. I mean, Solzhenitsyn becomes a Christian while in prison, largely through the witness of Christian prisoners that he meets. He obviously becomes disillusioned with communism, seeing the ugly face of it and what it does to its own people, and becomes a Christian. And then he gets cancer, and it's thought to be terminal, and he thinks he's going to die. And that's the sort of the final straw that leads to his complete conversion, the near-death experience, the acceptance and embrace of death and suffering. Led to his conversion to Christianity. And then, after Stalin's death, there was a very brief window in which the Soviet leaders were happy to allow to have published material that was critical of Stalin. And it was during that very brief window that One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich was published, and was, of course, instantly a bestseller, and was also published in the West, so Solzhenitsyn became known globally. And, of course, very soon afterwards, the Soviet Union reverted to type and banned all works attacking anything to do with the Soviet Union, including Stalin. So, but of course, the cat was out of the bag then. This novel had been published and was published in the East as well as the West. And Solzhenitsyn continued to write novels that were banned in the Soviet Union but were smuggled out of the Soviet Union by dissidents and published in the West. So Solzhenitsyn became known internationally, much to the embarrassment of the Soviet authorities.
One Day in the Life is actually a small volume. Everyone who would want to enter into his work, that's a great starter, because unlike the Gulag, which is voluminous, speaking of course the Gulag Archipelago, but the One Day in the Life, it is an extraordinary read.
Yeah, it's very powerful. I mean, as you say, it's short, it's compact, and it literally does, the novel literally does tell the life of a typical prisoner in a typical Soviet labor camp, just one day in the life. And of course, the mind-boggling aspect of it, after you've read this sort of short, compact, powerful account of the horrors of life in the Soviet prison system, you think, wow, that's just one day. He has to do it over 365 days times five. You know, and of course, most people didn't survive that labor camp experience. It killed them. You know, only the most healthy or those who got lucky by getting transferred to something not quite so so deadly, survived the experience. And there's a character in the novel, Alyosha the Baptist, and he's the Christian presence in that novel. And again, you know, he's the one that shows hope that transcends the despair of the camp.
Mm-hmm. So in his writings, and his Christianity is seen but not seen. I mean, he conveys an incredible depth to what we understand as the virtuous life, as opposed to what it, if it's not lived out, what it becomes.
Yeah, I think Solzhenitsyn, although he was a very committed Christian himself, he was living in the Soviet Union, of course, where, first of all, it was a very secular culture, and he wanted to address, he wanted his audience he knew was secular, but also, you know, Christianity was still technically illegal, so he knew that he would not get novels published there if it was overtly Christian. But the Christianity is certainly subsumed within novels such as Cancer Ward and First Circle, and there are Christian characters that are prevalent. But of course, you know, in short stories such as Easter Procession, contradistinction between the faith of the Christians at Easter, the obnoxious crudeness and crassness of the secular youths that sort of mock the procession, and it speaks very powerfully that, you know, the absence of Christianity leads to the lowest sort of denominator of barbarism.
When the reader wants to encounter Russian writing, a lot of times they encounter Dr. Zhivago and Boris Pasternak and that type of thing. How would you compare Solzhenitsyn's writings to his work or to other writers of that era?
Well, I think that Solzhenitsyn is a greater writer than Pasternak. I think there's people that you should compare Solzhenitsyn with as being his peers would be the great 19th century Russian novelists Tolstoy and Dostoevsky. Mm-hmm. And particularly Dostoevsky, Solzhenitsyn basically follows in the noble tradition and the footsteps of Dostoevsky in writing profoundly political and yet also profoundly Christian and religious works of literature that are not just, should we say, certainly not pulp fiction, but literature in the best and highest sense of the word.
What should we look for as we enter into a Solzhenitsyn book? I mean, how would you want the reader to, you know, to kind of frame themselves as they open up the pages?
Well, there's a couple of things. I mean, a parallel I often make about Solzhenitsyn is with the fictional character in George Orwell's novel 1984. In 1984, the protagonist is Winston Smith, and of course, he's the one that stands up against the tyranny of Big Brother. Big government, a totalitarian state. And in Orwell's novel, the individual, Winston Smith, is crushed utterly and totally by the state. So the message of the novel is that ultimately Big Brother, fascism, communism, totalitarianism, will always crush the individual and the individual conscience, and there's no hope. Whereas in actual fact, that's a work of fiction, but in actual, the truth is not only stranger than fiction, but it has a happier ending because, you know, Solzhenitsyn took on Big Brother in real life. He went to prison. He was treated appallingly. He went into exile. There was an assassination attempt on his life. He was thrown out of the country and forced to live in exile with his family. So he was attacked brutally by Big Brother, by communism, and yet he predicted that he would outlive Big Brother, outlive the totalitarian regime. Most people thought he was mad when he said that, and yet, you know, the Iron Curtain collapses, the Berlin Wall comes down, 1989, 1990, Solzhenitsyn, as he predicted and prophesied, returned to his native land, to Russia in 1994, and spent the last 14 years of his life there, growing actually in kudos amongst the Russian people. When he first returned home, they didn't want him because they were drunk with the hedonism of the West immediately after the coming down of the wall. But as the sort of that turned sour with the mafia taking control and the corruption and then the economic downturn, Solzhenitsyn emerged as a prophet. And by the time he did, you know, he was really the grand old man of Russia that, you know, even the president, the prime minister sort of, you know, basically almost genuflected before.
Wow. Now, he, again, as you pointed out, was able to get out of the Soviet Union. It came to the West at a time when there was the great breaking down of the walls, that communism was beginning to collapse. And so often we think of Pope John Paul II and Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher. Where would you say Solzhenitsyn fits in that part of that destruction of that wall?
Well, I would say that, you know, from the perspective of those outside the Soviet system, because obviously, you know, Gorbachev and Yeltsin and people like that within the Soviet system played their part once things started to crumble in helping to bring it down, as it were. On a global level, I would say the five figures that stand up more than any others for helping to bring down communism are the three you've mentioned, Reagan, Thatcher, John Paul II, but also Lech Wałęsa, the leader of the Solidarity Union in Poland, and Alexander Solzhenitsyn. So he's one of that top five. And in the 1970s, before, you know, Thatcher or Reagan or John Paul II came on the scene, he was really, or Lech Wałęsa, he was standing alone, really, as the person that was defying communism as a dissident. He was known dissident of all. And in the 70s, when everyone thought communism was indestructible, he predicted its downfall. And of course, you know, with the coming of John Paul II, his statue in 79, Reagan in 1980, the 1980s saw the tide turn against communism and its downfall at the end of that decade.
Mm. Did he have a relationship with those individuals?
Well, he certainly had great respect for John Paul II. When I was interviewing him at his home just outside Moscow, I asked him directly, you know, what did he think of John Paul II? And he looked him in the eye and he said, oh, he's a great man, one of the greatest men of the century. He recounted his private audience with John Paul II in the Vatican and clearly considered him a hero against communism. But the other thing he said, which I found very interesting, is he said that, you know, people think that I'm a Slavophile in the sense of being anti-Western. He said, I'm not anti-Western. I see Russia as part of Western civilization. And if the Iron Curtain had come down and the cream of Western civilization had come over the top, I'd be the first to rejoice. He said, well, what actually happened was that the Iron Curtain came up and the dregs and the scum, if you like, the dregs of Western civilization seeped under it, the pornography, the corruption, the mafia, the hedonism. And that was what he opposed, the dregs of the West. And he said that, in fact, the Catholic Church has a lot to teach the Russian Orthodox Church, because the Catholic Church engages in politics and political issues, and the Russian Orthodox Church stands aloof, and you can't stand aloof from these issues. And he mentioned John Paul II's you know, views, as in Centesimus Annus, his encyclical, and, you know, the previous encyclicals of Pius XI and Leo XIII, and how the Church's social teaching does offer the correct answers to the political and social problems of the modern age. And indeed, Solzhenitsyn's own political writings, and there are quite a few of them, echo and reflect and parallel the teaching of the Church. So in that also, Catholics have a lot to learn from Solzhenitsyn, because he expresses Catholic social teaching in profound ways.
He really is a unique voice, because he can articulate the importance of Catholic social teaching as one who is a victim of when it's not practiced.
Exactly. And the other thing about him, of course, he experienced communism from the inside in a brutal way. So he certainly can speak as a witness to the dangers of big government, to the dangers of socialism, the one extreme. But he also, of course, in his famous Harvard address in 1978, spoke out about the materialism of the West also, and that ultimately the communist East and the, should we say, hedonistic capitalist West share the same fundamental philosophical materialism and the same desire to marginalize God and to push religion out of the public square. And, you know, he pointed out the uncomfortable truth that, in actual fact, in these things, there's not that much difference between the materialism of the East and the materialism of the West. They're both sort of products of the Enlightenment. And he said, basically, we need to get back to a God-centered politics, a God-centered society, a family-oriented culture. So, you know, reflecting exactly the teaching of the Catholic Church on these issues.
It's amazing. We've had these moments in history in the late 20th century where I'm recalling that image of the young man who stood before the tank in China in Tiananmen Square saying, stop. In these great speeches, you have people like Alexander Solzhenitsyn at Harvard in 1978, or a Mother Teresa with her speech at the dinner decrying abortion in the United States. These individuals with their words at those moments going up at a leviathan of a culture.
Absolutely. It's almost as if, you know, these talks are touchstones by which we can tell, you know, where people stand. I mean, to this day, for instance, I can find out immediately where someone stands on the political and social issues of the day by asking them, you know, what they thought of Social Nixon's Harvard address of 1978. And if they're old enough and educated enough to know what I'm talking about, you know, if they're in favor of that speech, it means basically they're on the side of the good and the church. If they're opposed to that speech, it means basically they're their first loyalty to some ideology, whether it's big government socialism or big business capitalism, as opposed to the, you know, if, should we say, the via media, the middle path of common sense, of sanity offered by the church's social teaching and indeed Social Nixon's own social position.
Do you suppose that's why he is not lifted up more in American media, at the very least, as someone who spoke out, of course, against communism, but because he also challenged about big business, not unlike G.K. Chesterton?
Exactly. That's exactly why he's not so well known, because what happened, you know, up until 1978, everybody saw Social Nixon as a hero, whether it was the left or the right, Democrat, Republican, socialist or conservative. You know, everyone was on the side of Solzhenitsyn when he was just a hammer they could use to beat communism with. But when Solzhenitsyn, you know, made his Harvard address and said, you know, don't be so smug, you know, there were big problems, you know, in the West as well, with this culture of death and ethno-massacres and this hatred of Western civilization, etc. You know, then the liberals turned against him vociferously, vehemently. The president's wife, Rosalind Carter, came out, you know, publicly to say, you know, well, there's nothing wrong with America, to defend America. You know, and of course there's things wrong with America. I mean, there's things wrong with every country, and there's no room to be glib and supercilious. We all have problems to address. Since Roe versus Wade, 50 million unborn babies have been killed in this country. That in itself is a problem. And there are other, you know, economic and social problems that this country needs to address, and Social Nixon had the courage to say so. And as I say, his position is very similar to the position of the Catholic Church. And you know, I found just about nothing Social Nixon's, you know, obviously I could probably name little quibbly things, but you know, 98% of the things that Social Nixon's written about, I find myself in complete agreement with. He's an orthodox, tradition-oriented Christian, who understands the political and economic malaise of the day through Orthodox Christian eyes.
So what did he think of your first edition of his life story?
He was very positively disposed towards it, which is why I got the cooperation, not of Social Nixon, of course, because he'd passed away, but I received the cooperation of Social Nixon's wife and his three sons in you know, getting together the material we needed, and including new photographs that published in the edition that were sent to me by Solzhenitsyn's wife that have never been published elsewhere, some of them. So, you know, exclusive photographs. That's an indication and indeed a vindication of the fact that the Solzhenitsyn family, including Solzhenitsyn himself, were happy I consider that they believed, as I believe, that I fulfilled my promise to publish a work on Solzhenitsyn that was true to the centrality of Orthodox Christianity in his life.
Well, many are aware that he came to the United States, he came to the West, and then he went back, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, the point is he loved his native land. He loved Russia. He didn't actually leave the Soviet Union. He was thrown out of the Soviet Union, forced into exile with his family, and spent 20 years, most of it in the United States, in Vermont. His children were educated, etc. Loved many aspects of American life, but always considered himself to be Russian and always desired to go home. And of course, once the Iron Curtain came down, he did indeed return home and was very, very happy at living back on his in his native land.
So what in the new edition do we know about his life? I mean, as far as how he felt about the state of the world up until, of course, his death, 2008.
Well, I mean, there were basically problems in the wake of communism, that instead of communism being destroyed and replaced with a traditional Western Christian culture in the East, what had largely happened was what happened really was that people that had been denied freedom just went mad and got drunk on, should we say, the lowest elements of so-called freedom, licentiousness. And, you know, he said that, you know, Russia and Eastern Europe has exited from communism in the worst way imaginable. So, yes, it's better than communism, but really things could and should have been much better. So, you know, there are problems in the East. He sees global problems with an unsustainable system of economics where technology is ultimately, should we say, accelerating everything in such a way. And philosophers will tell you that acceleration is not a stable situation. So we're moving in untried, untested directions at an accelerated pace. And Solzhenitsyn certainly thought this boded ill for the future and thought that there would be major problems for the global economy. And of course, I think we're seeing the beginning of that now.
Well, we certainly have. I just think there is still so much to learn from him in his works and many of the, you know, the warnings that he gave us, not unlike Chesterton. I mean, there's such a parallel in many ways, even though they came from completely different backgrounds. The message is, at its heart, essentially the same, isn't it?
The great surprises that I found, before Solzhenitsyn came down, when I went to his house, his wife showed me around their house in Moscow and showed me, made a point of pointing out, on his bookshelves, a whole row of the Ignatius collected works of G.K. Chesterton.
Wow.
So Solzhenitsyn obviously was a great admirer of Chesterton. And the thing that he has in common with Chesterton and Tolkien, and I asked him about Tolkien, again, quotes about Tolkien, and he completely agreed with the things that I was saying and things that Tolkien was saying, is that basically the acceptance of suffering is the beginning of wisdom and, you know, the embrace of the cross. And this is very much Solzhenitsyn's position, that it was the position of these great Catholic writers. Now, he's one of them. You know, I wrote an article for a Moscow literary journal, you know, Solzhenitsyn's Western Literary Confreres, you know, his brothers in arms, as it were, and, you know, Chesterton, Tolkien, C.S. Lewis, T.S. Eliot. Now, these are all people that are kindred spirits with Solzhenitsyn. He is just the, should we say, the Eastern Europe equivalent of them.
I would highly recommend Solzhenitsyn, A Soul in Exile by Joseph Pierce, especially the new edition by Ignatius Press. It's the first stop in this exploration of the life of Alexander Solzhenitsyn and his writings. What would you encourage folks to begin in their study when it comes to the literary work?
I would start with my book, and then if guests want to know which of Solzhenitsyn's books to start with, I would agree with you that probably the most accessible way to begin would be his first novel, One Day in the Life, because it's short and powerful.
Well, there are so many other things I would love to touch on. I just wish we had more time. I mean, we didn't even get into the KGB plot to assassinate him. What is it about the KGB?
People have to buy the book to find out exactly how the KGB tried to assassinate Solzhenitsyn. That's a little teaser.
I know. It is a remarkable work, and they could always be thrilled, because when you write, you make it into the great story deserving of that person's life. And so it's always in a master's hands.
Thank you.
Any final thoughts, Joseph?
Well, not only that, I think that any serious Catholic lover of literature, or indeed lover of the Church that in the modern world and what that means, really should and needs to know more about Alexander Solzhenitsyn. So, you know, don't wallow in your ignorance, I would say, but find out more, because it's a discovery which will enrich you.
Thank you so much, Joseph Pierce.
My pleasure. Thank you, Chris. God bless you.
We've been going inside the pages of Solzhenitsyn, A Soul in Exile, the revised and updated edition by Joseph Pierce. To learn more about this book or to obtain a copy, go to Ignatius.com, the website for Ignatius Press, or you can find it at any fine Catholic bookstore. To hear and download this episode along with many others, go to www.insidethepages.com. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join me next time for Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors.